Good morning, and I'm glad that you're here. First, a small question, which is, how was the homework set? Maybe it's a shock, but I guess formally it is due today. But if you don't have it, I'll take it this afternoon or tomorrow, or maybe next week if you need it. Some of the problems are surprisingly tricky. Well, we don't have any background and no theory yet, so the problems are really just free-ranging. But today we're starting with more theory. I want to talk about the heat equation. That's the next item on the syllabus. So really, section two, the heat equation. Which leads me to a reminder that I said several times in my first lecture, which was really an introductory lecture, I said something to the effect that this is the Fourier transform, this is the inverse transform, it works if F is sufficiently good, in quotes. I just want to remind you that I'm leaving that for the moment free. I don't want to encumber the task of teaching the course with a semester worth of preamble before I actually talk about a differential equation. So, in fact, we're doing something which is a little bit less than precise. We're going to come in a few sessions to make that precise. But I'm saying that because I'm going to do the same crime today. I'm going to talk about if solutions are sufficiently good, then they have to look like this. But in fact, we haven't stated that they wouldn't be sufficiently good. So that's my disclaimer. If you're really rigorous, you would say I'm speaking as a poet rather than a mathematician. Okay, well, that's true. But I think we're still learning things, and we're making progress. Okay? Oh, incidentally, who is here who was not here last week? I can't ask the other question, who is not here who was here last week, but you're new. Well, very good. At the end of class, will you write my sign-up sheet so I know your name and who you are? Nothing formal, but just it's nice to know who's coming to the class. Good. So the heat equation, and we're working on Fourier transform techniques. So the idea is that the interesting historical fact is Fourier initially introduced the Fourier transform to study the heat equation. So here we are at the basics. He actually studied Fourier series and with a Fourier transform, but nonetheless. So here's the equation I want to study today. I'm looking for a function u, and it's a function of x and t, and x is going to be one-dimensional. But it turns out that most of the time in what I say, it doesn't matter. It's just going to be easier notation. And later I'll modulate into x being general and dimensional. So I hope it's not confusing that I'm sticking to one dimension. It's just easier to write things down in one dimension. And d by dt u is supposed to equal something. So I want it to be 1/2 dx squared u. And then I'm going to take x in one dimension, but all of one dimension. I'm going to also take t on the... Well, take t what I can. T is going to be on the positive real axis. Okay? The first thing I want to notice is Brownian scaling. Which is the following extremely simple thing. That if I set t prime is equal to epsilon t, I'm going to take epsilon a real number. Could be... Sometimes it's small, but here it doesn't matter. Could be 1. And x prime is equal to root epsilon x. And and I rescale the equation by this, then a solution is transformed to a solution, by which I mean the following thing. Set u prime, that's a new function. It's going to be a function of x prime and t prime, and I simply want it to be u, but not of x and t, but u of root epsilon x, epsilon t. And then if I also derive the consequences of that change of variable, it's a very simple change of variables, Nonetheless, you have to get the epsilons in the right places. So this turns dt becomes epsilon dt prime, and this turns dx into root epsilon dx prime. And then it turns out, of course, that u prime will satisfy an equation, just basically using the chain rule. So let's do that. I look at dt minus half dx squared u prime is equal to epsilon dt prime minus half root epsilon dx prime squared, so that brings out an epsilon 2 applied to u prime, and that we find is equal to epsilon times dt minus half dx squared u, just by the change of variables formula, which is 0 because it's a solution. So solutions are mapped to solutions. And the comment is that, so two comments. One is that we will see the ratio of x squared over t very often in the solution procedure. And we'll also, it's related to probability. So related to many things in probability. And we'll see that in more extent when we enter Brownian motion, theory of Brownian motion, but that's some months from now. What's something in probability that looks like this? Well, if you look at a random process and you average it for a long time, it's going to behave like its mean value. That's called the law of large numbers. And if you look at a random process minus its mean value, so it has mean value 0, and you look at it for and you average it for a long time, that means 0. That's what the law of large numbers means. But if you don't average it, meaning you don't take 1 upon t sum up to t, but 1 over square root t, that's the realm of the central limit theorem. That's Brownian. That's square root is the same square root as we're looking at, Brownian scaling. Okay, so that's comment 1. Comment 2 is I want to derive the fundamental solution. So what I want to do is derive the heat kernel. So in doing this, I'll tell you what the heat kernel is, of course. And it's by, so we're concentrating on doing things using the Fourier transform. So I'm going to derive the heat kernel by Fourier, by using the Fourier transform. Maybe it's a fancy way to say is Fourier synthesis. So, what we'll do is, and I want to do this not for all possible solutions, but solutions which are good enough to fit into the rubric of the Fourier transform. So let's recall the Fourier inversion formula. Which is that I can write u of x t is equal to 1 upon root 2 pi integral e to the I c x u hat of c. Now t is a parameter, so u hat of c also depends as a parameter d c. And then if this is a function of x and t, and I want it to be a solution, so if it being a solution, being a solution of 1 means that it has to satisfy something. It has to satisfy 0 is equal to dt minus 1 half dx squared applied to u of xt. And let me put this into the, yes? Well, I just turned this into this. You see, that into that. Depends on how you think about changing variables, right? what I want to do is put all these derivatives inside the integral, which is one of these poetical crimes that I'm doing for the moment. But allow me, please. When I take a d by dt, the only t is on u hat, so I preserve the e to the I cx dt u hat of ct. When I take each d by dx, well, surely I get a half. Half is easy to put inside the integral. When I take each d by dx, the x's are on here. So I'm going to get an ic twice. So ic squared u hat ct dx. And for this to be equal to 0, and with our comment on the Fourier inversion formula, it implies that we have to solve an ODE. Which is in T, parameterized by C. But this is the same. This is the same story that we had last week with our first order wave equation. So it's the same story. It's just a different ODE. So we'll solve it. Solve this. And, you know, it's kind of, you can read it off. D by dt, u hat, excuse me for being pedantic, minus 1 half ic squared. I squared is minus 1, so I can put a plus 1 half c squared u hat equals 0. And that has to be, this has to be true for all c. And we can solve this, of course, with u hat of c t is equal to e to the minus 1 half c squared t u hat of c 0. Just check, please. Next time I'm going to make you do it. And then we know something about u hat at 0. It's supposed to be, whoops, I forgot my initial data. Good thing I had it. U of x 0 equals f of x. Good thing I had it when I wrote down the heat equation last Wednesday. So this has to be e to the minus I 1 half c squared t f hat of c. Because the Fourier transforms at the origin have to agree. And then that gives us a solution formula. So that's number two. This is a solution formula. And I'm sure many people have already seen this. So I apologize. But what we're going to do from that is now deduce properties of the solution formula. Sorry, we're going to deduce properties of the solution staring at this formula, which is kind of a nice thing to do, because you can get quite reasonably far. And furthermore, I want to also use it to introduce more facts about the Fourier transform. So in some sense, we're learning the Fourier transform by subterfuge, looking at excuses, you know, using these equations as excuses. Well, I just want to plug this in, let's see, this and that formula with this. So that says u of x t, I'm just copying, it's equal to 1 upon root 2 pi integral e to the I cx. Then what did we say u hat was? It's this thing. So I just copy e to the minus 1 half c squared t u hat c0. That's f hat of c. And I do one integral. And then if you permit me, I want to remind you that f hat of c is in the inverse Fourier transform. So 1 upon root 2 pi t integral e to the minus I c, but now I need another variable, y, f of y dy. So I'm going to write that here. Now I have 1 upon 2 pi and another one from f hat. So 1 upon 2 pi with no square root, integral, integral, because I have two integrals. E to the I c x, e to the minus I c y. e to the minus 1/2 c squared t f of y dy dx. Another line, excuse me. I'm going to write it as follows. Outer integral, I want to be dy. Inner integral, I want to be 1 upon 2 pi. Inner integral, I'm doing now the C integral. Oh, I'm exchanging integrations. Another illegal operation without further argument, so please forgive me. I'm going to do the dx integral, e to the I c x minus y, e to the minus 1/2 c squared t dx. I can now close the parentheses. I didn't leave enough room, so excuse me, f of y dy. And it now becomes of very great interest to evaluate this integral, which we'll do in a sec. What I want to do is give it a name, actually. This is a function. It's integrated out to c, but it's a function of t and of x minus y. So this is h for the heat equation. It's a function of x minus y and t. And I take that function, that's what's in the parentheses, and I integrate fy dy. And I integrate it in y. That kind of integral has a name. Convolution product. This is a convolution or a convolution product. Thanks. So, and H is the heat kernel. So H of course, if I know it at X, I just, by translation, I know it at X minus Y. So H of XT is the heat kernel. And we're going to spend the rest of the morning thinking about it. Incidentally, anyone have a hint? How would I justify that exchange of integration if I were not to sin? For example, the Fubini theorem, which is a real variables theorem, Lebesgue measure theorem that talks about when, in what circumstances, you can interchange integrations. And because this is so rapidly decreasing as C gets large, that helps in this affair. Okay. Just one moment. I want to say H is the heat kernel, and the operation of solving the equation, or you might say the flow of evolution of the differential equation, I'm going to call sort of a boldface H. So the solution operator. So that says I get U of XT from taking my data F of X, and then flowing by some operation which depends on t. And that's an operator, x. You might say I take the operator on f, and then I evaluate the result at x. And this is the heat. This is a, you can say this is the heat flow. Or the solution operator of the heat equation. Okay, and now, as I said, let's do this integral. Probably everyone's already done it in their heads, except me. So it's hard to think while you're standing up. So I'm going to do it in front of you. So H, so evaluate. So H of X, T, 1 upon 2 pi integral, e to the I, C, X, e to the minus 1/2, C squared T, dx. And you also see why people tend to put that 1/2 as a diffusion coefficient in the equation. Sorry, leave a little room in your notes. 1 over 2 pi. Maybe I should have left a little bit more room. Because I want to do the following thing. I'd like to multiply and divide by a complex exponential, e to the minus x squared upon 2t. Sorry, I had to squeeze that in. It's a function of x, so it doesn't have anything to do with the integral, right? And I can put the other factor, e to the x squared over 2t. Still the same. And now I'd like to complete the square. Which is 1 upon 2 pi which is, let me do it this way. That's right, 1 upon 2 pi. Oh, that's good. 1 and 2 pi. E to the minus x squared upon 2t. By the way, do you see the ratio x squared over 2t? Of course. It's already there. Integral. E to the, putting all exponents together, x squared over 2t, something's missing here. No, x, that's okay. That's okay. Plus I c x minus c squared t over 2 dc. And I'm going to immediately replace this by, it's a square, so I'm going to replace it by minus 1 half times the quantity c root t minus I x over root t quantity squared. And then, of course, one should substitute. So I'm going to say now C prime is equal to C root T minus I X over root T. And that means that DC prime is equal to dc root t. There's another root t which I needed. And I'll rewrite this as 1 upon 2 pi e to the minus x squared over 2t integral e to the minus 1 half, this is c prime squared d c prime over root t. That's that root t that I needed. And if I just do this integral, I get, if I do this integral, I take the square root out, and I do this integral, I get root 2 pi. So I get 1 upon root 2 pi t. That's the root t, and that's the remaining root 2 pi, e to the minus x squared over 2t. Interesting. So, sorry? Thank you. I was going to sneak it in later. Actually, I was going to say exactly that right now, which is this substitution is just a change of variables. In fact, it's Cauchy's theorem. Because I'm not just replacing a real number by a real number, I'm moving a contour into the complex plane. So I just wanted to note is, this substitution is really Cauchy's theorem. But I was chastised before I could bring it up, showing I'm actually innocent. I was planning to say that. So let's just state our theorem. And I seem to have converged upon a numbering system for my theorems, which is on last Wednesday I had in section 2 theorems, propositions or definitions 1, 2, and 3, so here it's 4. And we're in section 2 on Fourier transform, so it's 2.4. Let's see if I can stick to it. The theorem is the Fourier solution to the heat equation is given by convolution with the heat kernel. So that is really formula 4, which is u of x t 1 upon root, let me say it this way, is equal to the integral h of x minus y t f of y dy, but h is 1 upon root 2 pi t e to the minus x minus y squared over 2 t f y dy. Point. Appropriateness of Brownian scaling. Here's an x minus y squared over t. That's Brownian scaling, centered around y rather than around 0. Here's an extra root t. Where does that go? With the dy, of course. It's an operator. It's not the kernel isn't everything. It's an operator, which obeys the Brownian scaling. Good. This solution procedure, just to say, I'm not going to analyze this right now, but this solution procedure gives unique solutions among a class of solutions. Okay, among the class of bounded solutions, or among the class of L1 solutions, or maybe among the class of L2 solutions, or even among the class of solutions which don't grow too rapidly. It was a shock when somebody showed about 50 years ago, 40 maybe, I'll look up the reference, that it's not unique among all possible solutions, that there are some solutions which have huge heat reservoirs at infinity. That is, they grow enormously in amplitude as x goes to infinity, that start at zero. And so solutions of the heat equation are not unique per se, but they're unique among large classes of solutions. We'll return to that. That's just a reminder. So unique. So this solution is unique. I'm just making a statement. I'm not backing it up. Among L infinity or L1 or L2 or at least not too badly unbounded. That's just a fact, part of the facts of life. Surprising. Sorry?
You can add a harmonic function to U, which Laplacian is zero.
Yeah. But generally, if you add a harmonic function, you will change f. You change f. So uniqueness has something to do with if f is zero. That is, if you take f1 and f2, well, you take a solution u1 and u2, starting with functions f1 and f2. But if f1 equals f2, then does u1 equal u2? So take the difference. It also satisfies the equation. If f is zero, do you have a non-trivial solution? And the answer is no among these classes, but there exist non-trivial solutions, which start at zero, which grow enormously as x is large. We're coming back to that in rather many months. I just want to say it's not the full story. I'm either putting you off or whetting your appetite. I don't know, but take it as that. I'm not proving it at this point. It's just one of the facts. Let me try to be an artist. What does heat kernel look like? Here's x. Here's y. I want to draw h of x minus y t, and I'm going to choose various t's. So let's take a t very small. So let's make a drawing with t positive, but very small. Then there's hardly any heat has gotten out to infinity. And a huge reservoir of heat still sitting here, but it's spreading out and it's smooth and has height 1 upon root t, 1 upon root 2 pi t, in fact. So if t is small, it's very large, but finite. 2. If t is about order 1, then it's spreading out and coming down. And, of course, it's a Gaussian. And if 3, t is quite large, then it's long and low. It's spreading its heat all over everywhere. They're always Gaussian. It's just the size of the thing. Okay. Here's a simple observation that you want out of a system which has a physical interpretation such as this. Well, you want anyway, but you surely should expect in such a case. So observation. Let's see how I want to do this. Think of the solution operator, h, of t. It starts with f, f of it starts with functions f of x, and after time, t gives a solution u of xt. So we start at 0, we go to t. But we could also do the following thing. You could also go to s. So let's take s, where 0 is less than s, is less than t. And then you take f of x, and you go to time s. And then you restart, and you go from s, and then you go s to t. So you restart with data here, u of x and s, and you go to u of x and t. And the question, so to restart, I take whatever happens for h of s, and then I take h. And to do the remaining time, I have to do t minus s. And the question is, and this might be u prime. And the question is, are they the same? And the answer is related to uniqueness. But let's stay within our categories that I've asserted are unique, give us uniqueness, and then it should hold true. So that gives us an opportunity for a problem set problem. This is called the semigroup property. Am I clear? It says, show the operator h of t is equal to the operator h of t minus s, h of s composed with the operator h of t minus s. Okay? At least within the solutions that are addressable by the Fourier transform. Okay? And to do that, you have to do a calculation. So I want you to show, and this is for 0 less than s less than t. Otherwise, it's not so clear. Show the semigroup property. For heat flow. Good. So the heat operation, the heat kernel is an the way the heat operator works is it's a convolution operator, and so it's one of many large class of possible convolution operators. So I just wanted to use the opportunity to talk a bit about convolution. So here's a definition. So instead of having an arbitrary capital H, of x and t being this Gaussian, I'm going to take an arbitrary H. So let H, but we're supposed to think of it as this doing the same job, and I want it to be L1 on R. And I want it to be L1, or else it could be, or otherwise, sufficiently good. You know, our disclaimer that it has to be good so that we can do the following operations. To be able to perform the following operations. I'm just trying to say that it's, I'm giving facts, but they're not the unique setting in which these facts hold. Okay? I want to then, we have this H, I want to define the convolution product. Where I want to say this, the convolution product with a function f of x. And I'll have also this f in L1 of R, although we could free that up a bit. So that's my formula 6, which is H star f of x is equal to the integral over r of h of x minus y times f of y dy. That's it. And then, because then that's a definition, and we just observe, is that it's just simply notation, but now we can write the heat operator. So the heat operator, taking f, so that's a solution of the heat equation is given by the heat operator on initial data f, can be written as you take the convolution kernel, you take the heat kernel parameterized by t, and you take a convolution product, that means with respect to the x's there, and you evaluate it at point x. A lot of parentheses just to keep things straight. Question? Anyone clear on that? This? Oh. Or otherwise sufficiently good to be able to perform the following operations. That's what I wrote. It's kind of a disclaimer for my slightly fuzzy setting right now. So I like to make progress without getting bogged down in the analysis, although the analysis is important. So I have some statements I want to make. I'm using this to make some statements about convolution. So let's move over here and start doing that. So proposition. Which is, I want to take h of x and f of x, let's make them both integrable. Then the convolution product is, well, I guess I want to say, I have something that I just popped in my mind that is not in my notes. I guess I should put it into the proposition. Is 1 well-defined? I better put it 0 because I have another 1 in my notes. Well-defined. It's a well-defined L1 function. Property 1 is it's commutative and associative. These are sort of what you learn in analysis class as the basic properties of convolution. 2, what did I have in mind? If in addition, we have not just h and f are in L1, but dxf is in L1, then I take the derivative of the convolution product, and it's the h of dx of f. That is, partial derivative commutes with convolution. That is, dx commutes with convolution. And third property, which actually I'm going to prove first, is that what happens when you interact with the Fourier transform on the convolution product? So I'm going to take a convolution product. So what should I call this? Fourier transform. Under Fourier transform. I have h star f, that's some integral. And now I take it, and I take its Fourier transform, and that's a function of c. And the claim is this is h hat of c, f hat of c. Is this right? There's only one annoying root 2 pi in front. In the world where 2 pi is equal to 1, which is often the case in mathematics papers, this is true. That's right. It reminded me of that equal sign when I talked about the joke I gave in my first lecture. There's another joke. You read very complicated papers in Fourier analysis, and the first statement is let 2 pi equals 1. Then it just saves a lot of writing and accumulation of annoying constants, but it does look a little funny if you're an outsider to the field. So a view of saying this is that a view of this is that the Fourier transform diagonalizes convolution operators. And so I can actually even say 3 implies 2 by saying we already know the Fourier transform diagonalizes the derivative, and then 2 says the derivative commutes with convolution. And so if they commute and you diagonalize one, then you diagonalize the other just by linear algebra. But I'll do that by hand. Okay, so proof. Did you catch that? I'll do it by hand. So what we'll do is, let's show property 3. So show property 3. Oh, I forgot I'm supposed to show property 0. Whoops, better show property 0. And now, it's very hard, you find when you lecture, it's very hard to think on your feet, and I haven't prepared a damn thing. Well, at least let's try it. Which is, I have to show that the L1 norm of a convolution product, what I have to show is this is less than infinity. So I have to show is if F and H are both in L1, then the convolution product is less than or equal to infinity. So let's write that out. It says I have an integral of h of x minus y, f of y, dy, that's the convolution product, and I take the absolute value. Now I have to integrate this dx, and I have to show that that's less infinity if f and h both have absolute value of their absolute values integrable. So my first claim is, whatever this is, I can make the inner number bigger if I take the absolute, it's an absolute value of a sum, and that's going to be dominated by the sum of the absolute values. So I can say that this is definitely going to be bounded above by the absolute value on the inside. And of course, the absolute value of H times F, I can put absolute values on each one. And now, well, I'm cheating because I'm helping you. It's not fair because I'm helping you do the homework set now, because I'm going to say, use Fubini's theorem to exchange integrations. So Fubini, to exchange, you show that the integral in x for each y is bounded, and the double integral is bounded, then you can exchange integrations. So then I'd like to actually integrate first x and then y. So absolute value of h of x minus y dx, absolute value of f of y dy. And I see that this is actually dx is the same as dx minus y, so this in fact is y independent. In fact, this is known as, whoops, not f, but the L1 norm of h. That takes a constant out. The remainder is, of course, the L1 norm of f. So what we've just shown is the following inequality. And probably it's this that we should put in under item 0. That is, when you do a convolution product, you arrive at an L1 function, starting with 2 L1 functions. There's also more general facts related to this, but I'm going to leave that as this now, because I'm actually trying to talk about the heat equation. So let's go now to proof of the other things, but in fact I thought I'd start with 3. So let's see. What I have to do is I have to take the convolution product, so h of x minus y, f of y, dy, and I have to take its Fourier transform. So I do, and this is a function of x, because y is integrated out. E minus I cx integral dx. Don't forget the 1 upon root 2 pi. That's what I have to study. Oh, it is exactly that quantity on the bottom. H convolved with F, and now I'm taking the Fourier transform function of C. Sorry, got a little crowded on the board. And I'd rather write this as follows. 1 upon root 2 pi integral. Sum in the exponent is product of the exponentials, so I'm going to write this as e to the minus I c x minus y. I've put in an extra e to the I c y, so I have to take that out again. E to the minus I c y, and I'll put h of x minus y here and f of y there, dy dx. And now I just exchanged integrals. I made a double integral rather than iterated integrals. And just as we implied on the previous board, we should view the x integral first. So dx dy. And that's going to give us the following. If I do the x integral, this is the only thing that's implicated. Of course, integral of x prime, h of x prime, dx prime, x prime being x minus y on that inner integral, gives me a number which depends on c. So it's going to, times the 1 upon root 2 pi gives me x c. So that gives me h hat of c. And the remaining, and I've used the 1 upon root 2 pi. So the remaining integral is integral e to the minus I x c y f y dy. And it doesn't have a root 2 pi, so I have to supply one. So I multiply by root 2 pi, and I divide by root 2 pi and do that integral. It gives me f hat of c. That was fast, but look through your notes. It will be natural. That's what I wanted to prove. Now, let's move on to prove 2. Let's prove 2. Well, sorry, not 2. This is 3. I've done 0 and 3. Now I want to do 1. Well, let's just do the following thing. I have H and F, and we want to know about how the product interacts. But in fact, what I've just done is saying that is really HC F hat of C. And now, if I note this, it's pretty clear that on the Fourier side, it didn't matter which order I did anything, because it's just simply, for every c, I'm multiplying. So who cares? You could consider it f first or h first. So it had to be the same for h. So in some sense, I've reduced it to the obvious. Oh, that's commutativity. How about associativity? Iterate. You'll have a threefold product. And again, it doesn't matter which order you write it. It's just pointwise multiplication in C. So I'm going to say it's obvious. Which reminds me of a joke about Norbert Wiener, which is famous MIT mathematician, very deep, famously absent-minded, giving a lecture on one topic, probably Fourier analysis. One of the founders of the field, and he's lecturing on at top speed to a full lecture hall at MIT, and he goes, this is obvious, and this step is obvious, this step is obvious, and then this is obvious, and he hesitates and thinks about it, and he starts walking back and forth, and MIT has these long, it's all connected, has these long corridors and people's offices, and so he walks back and forth, and everyone's looking at him, and long minute, and then he goes out in the corridor and walks up and down the corridor. Then he goes to his office and starts writing on a piece of paper, and he throws them away and writes, so about 5 minutes, comes back, striding back later. Yes, it's obvious. And he carries on. So, it's obvious. If I do such a thing, you can ask me to explain. Okay? If ever. Two. How was I going to prove two? Well, didn't we decide that d by dx of the Fourier transform of something? Oh, you take d by dx of h of f. That's what's under question. And we decided the Fourier transform of that as a function of c was equal to I c times that something. And we've just been discussing that something. So it's I c h hat of c f hat of c. And now the I c doesn't care which function it looks at. It could be associated with h hat. It could be associated with f hat. Could be associated with the product. So in fact, we've proved more than two. We've proved that the derivative of h convolved with f is h convolved with the derivative of f, as long as that exists, or derivative of h convolved with f, or either one. So anyway, what can I say? It's obvious once you look at it in this way. Okay, but all the better for making progress. Okay, the heat equation, I want to now talk about the derivation. So that's a bunch of Fourier analysis. I want to talk rather now about the derivation of the heat equation. So this is the derivation. In some sense, I gave the equation and studied it, but I'd like to go back and pause for a second derive it. So we usually think of U of X as a density. Could be a heat density or a density of a particle distribution. So, and it comes out of stemming from an initial distribution. F of x. Well, f of x is the density. F of x dx, I guess, is the distribution. And so, an interpretation is that. So, interpret. You take u of x and t, and you take an integral, say, from a to b, dx, it's equal to, what I'm going to do is I'm going to call this probability of the interval a and b. So it's the, could we say, the amount of heat at that time t in the interval a and b. Or it could be introduced, interpreted as the probability of the outcome of a random event. For example, the probability that a random particle lies in the interval A and B, if we're taking the particle interpretation. And what I want to do is derive the heat equation from that interpretation. So let me do that as follows. I'm given this probability, A, B. I'm going to derive the heat equation from that statement and the one additional fact, which is Fourier's law for heat flux or for diffusion flux. So here's I pick AB. So it could be any AB, but I pick it and I fix it for the moment. And I want to know how the amount of heat changes in that time A and B. Well, it's equal to d by dt of the integral from a to b of u of x t dx. And let's say I'm deriving it, well, in the circumstances where u permits me to integrate under the integral sign. So a, b, dt u of x t dx. And now I want to say the statement is the only way the probability can change is if heat flows across the boundary of A and B. So so that, that's the conservation of heat. Actually, I lied to you. There are two principles I'm using. One is the conservation of heat, which I should have said first, and then the second one is going to be Fourier's law for heat flux across the boundaries. So the conservation of heat says the only way this could change is if heat flows in from A, it could increase from that, but also heat flows out from B, or vice versa. It depends on the signs of F. So F is a flux of heat through A and through B. Okay, so FA is flux of heat into the interval at side A. I mean, here's the interval, right? A, B, so F is coming in, minus F is going out. Okay? And now, Fourier, this is... I always use that just for probabilistic tradition. It's going to be independent of our considerations. You have to decide whether your integrated densities jump up or jump down, where the endpoints of jumps lie, and I just happened to put them up. Doesn't really matter in any of these considerations. Okay, so Fourier's law says the following, that F of A, let me get the sign right, F of A is going to be proportional to the derivative of U at A at that particular time t. And let's think about it. If the heat is decreasing across there, then flux should be coming in. So that dictates there should be a minus sign. And let's normalize by a half. That's the way the Gaussians come out. Otherwise, rescale to get your favorite number. Or put a diffusion constant in. That says, if I rewrite this, if I continue writing this equation, this is going to be equal to one half dx of u at A, I'll do the B first, B of t minus one half dx of u at A of t. And we can realize this as it's the evaluation at two endpoints of the derivative, of the integral of something, which is one half integral from A to B of dx squared u of x and t. Integrate the derivative, you get the value of the two endpoints. Okay, so let me rewrite that. I just want to rewrite that whole thing. It says that integral from A to B of dt u x t minus one half dx squared u of x t dx. And this has to be equal to 0. I took the left-hand side and subtracted the right-hand side. And this has to be 0 for all intervals A, B. It could be open or closed or semi-open, whatever you want. I'm just somehow taking that affectation of making them open like that. Well, of course, this implies that the dt among smooth solutions, as long as the smooth solution doesn't have a jump, dt of u equals half dx squared of u, which is our derivation. It is consistent with the idea of diffusion or heat. It's consistent with the idea of diffusion or heat, so it's consistent. If two properties are satisfied. So one property is total heat conserved. Because, of course, we're taking the heat or the probability of finding a particle in the interval A, B to satisfy a conservation law. So the total heat or the total probability of the particle being anywhere, you don't want it to increase or diminish. in time. So if it's going to be consistent if, one, the total heat is conserved, and two, if I start with f of x greater than or equal 0, then, that is, solutions can be perfectly well negative, but in this interpretation, they can't. It's a density of something. You don't have negative densities, at least not in the classical world. So if I start out with the density function, then we want u of x t always to be greater than or equal to 0 for all positive time, because you want to start out with a density and remain a density. So this is going to be a conservation law, and this is going to be the maximum principle. But it's time for a pause. So let's take a pause of about 5 minutes. That way we can relax and have a drink and or catch up with our notes. I'll have a pause. I need to rest my throat. Traffic was bad.
No, the traffic was not bad. I had to take him there and then back.
Then back home and bus. Oh boy. Yeah. I hope it's all right.
No,
I took an early bus and it was very late. Yeah. It wasn't so good. Yes. So I don't get a pause. Only the other people get a pause.
One second.
Yes.
Which theorem we could see an example? The name of that absolute value is less. It's not to be here. There is something. What's the name of that? Or this is normal.
I think it's everybody's theorem.
Yeah,
it's because an integral is a sum.
Okay.
So the integral is a sum. So I have.
Let's say x to the x or
So I have x1 times y1 plus x2 times y2 absolute value.
Or less than each absolute.
Then it's less than or equal to if I take the biggest the first one can be, the biggest, the absolute value of the first plus the absolute value of the second. Sort of obvious. So I think
for each function,
everybody's integral. You just contemplate it a little bit. I think it's everyone's. And then the integral's a sum. So you just say, well, for integrals too, it has to be true. That's probably it's not a mathematical argument.
Yeah, so that's
you have to think about it.
Okay, so always.
And that will suffice. That will suffice actually. For me, it's sort of, for me it's obvious. I hate to say obvious too often. But it's one of these facts of life. You can't add, you can't, there's the possibility of cancellation if you have absolute value around a sum. But if you take the largest of each one, there's no longer any, sum could be negative, sum could be positive.
Yeah, but here, even but if you took positive and negative, the absolute value would be positive.
Positive and positive, so it has to increase. That's the increase.
Yeah, and but here each one will be, could be equal.
H is positive and F is positive, these absolute values don't do anything.
Yeah.
So it's equal only if that case, actually. Only if that case. How are you?
Oh, good. Yeah.
Train on time? I took the bus and the traffic was terrible. Yeah. Very good. Very good. I think the Vias are really very fast.
Okay. I don't know, Matt was saying when he always took the bus whenever he really needed the Vias.
Except the rush hour.
Oh, okay.
Except the rush hour. Or other traffic perturbations.
That's true.
Yeah. Is it okay? This is a... Next week. Next week. All right. Is it making sense or not? Is it making sense? With a microphone and all, it's odd. Tiring.
Yeah. But there is also another seminar?
We have our seminar, and then there's the Toronto Colloquium that I want to go to also.
Oh, yeah, so, and
Wilhelm Schlag. Yeah. It'll be at the department. You can come with us. I'll go to that.
Oh, it's just after the first Colloquium?
Yeah, I think it's at 4.
What's
by Schlag. It's on the Toronto Colloquium. It's on the Anderson Localization. Anderson Localization.
Ah.
I know, I should turn this thing off.
So you're going to...
Let's start again. I mentioned the problem assignment, and I didn't get much. I was not flooded with papers, but feel free to hand them in. Maybe it's best after the lecture, because then we don't have to shuffle things around. But feel free to get them to me. Yes. Yeah, sure. I'm not sure experts are allowed to ask questions. I don't know. I see it better in terms of heat. Because usually you don't think of things evolving having to do with the steepness of the density, but indeed you derive it by other means. It's funny, isn't it?
Yeah. So how would you derive that, if you were thinking of
propagation and probability? Fourier's law is also not holy. It's simply how Fourier thought heat might propagate, and it makes sense, but it's not the only way heat could propagate. And in fact, if you looked at this fine structure behavior, it might be quite different. So, well, you have me there. Homework assignment: let's look up Einstein's 1905 paper on Brownian motion, which is a nice thing to do anyway, and just see what he said. I can't. I'm sorry. I'm failing you on my feet right now. That doesn't give me a choice of flux. That's a funny thing, though. So I can't give you a pat reason why that should be the flux if it's simply probability. But. Okay, but maybe after some thought. So next week we'll have a little report after some thought. Maybe it's obvious.
What if Fourier law just heat? So how
It says the heat flux is proportional to the gradient of the heat distribution. That's what it is. And I put the half in, and the sign is obvious. I should say obvious too much. The sign is the one which allows heat to flow into an area with less heat. That's what it should do. And the half is to make the equation come out nicely. And the half can be changed by rescaling.
So in principle, there can be some non-linear curves.
I'm sure in different media there could be a lot of different things. And if you look at the molecular level, it probably is wrong. Because, I mean, heat is starting to lose its meaning. An actual heat of a point is starting to lose its meaning if you're, you know, a small boy among large molecules floating around. It's only an average. It's only a statistical quantity. So let's move on. And what I want to do is verify these two tenets, which is it better be that total heat is conserved, and also better be that distribution maps to a distribution. That is, we don't get any negative heat if we start with a positive heat. So let's. This is actually in the form of a theorem. And it's 2.7 in our table. And this is basically the conservation of heat. The story goes as follows. If U of xt is L1, L1 solution of equation 1, then the integral of u x t dx is equal to the integral of x dx. And to tell you the truth, you don't even need the interpretation of heat, because u is allowed to change sign in this. It's simply a solution of the heat equation. One is the heat equation. Yeah, we lost one. It's on some long erased blackboard. And it's proof. Again, with that slight disclaimer over analytic rigor, is very straightforward. That is, I want to see what happens to the total heat as time goes on. So allowing myself to freely integrate under the integrand and using the equation that d by dt is related to 1/2 dx squared, and using unstated facts saying that if I start out with an L1 data, I'm going to have that my solution is actually going to have two derivatives, and I can integrate by parts, and those and the boundary terms will vanish on large balls. So that's going to say this is equal to 1/2 limit as r goes to infinity. The boundary term from integrating by parts, which is d by dx u of r t minus d by dx u of minus r t, and that if u is behaved enough so that these quantities go to zero as r gets large, I'm going to get zero, which in fact is the case. So therefore the total heat cannot change. That's the proof of our statement, or the only proof that we're going to get today. Let's worry about the next one, the maximum principle. that's what I want to state as theorem. I want to put it on the board, which is movable. R goes to infinity. That's an infinity. It doesn't look so good, but it's an infinity. So the second theorem of the suite is the maximum principle. So it does as follows. Let's suppose that f of x is, will qualify as a density. I guess densities probably should have integral 1 if it's a probability distribution. But let's ignore that and just say it's an initial data which is non-negative, 0 or positive. Statement is, then either two things can happen. U of x t is not only non-negative, but it's positive for all x. So either, what do I want to say? I want to say it this way. Then for t greater than 0, either u of x t is positive for all x, or else both f is identically 0 and u is identically 0. So in fact, a little spike of heat on Mars in the ideal universe an instant later will heat at least a small amount the entire universe. Okay, so here's the proof. That's right. So Vitaly has just proved it for us, but I'll prove it again. It's from the integral representation formula, as he says. So observe the heat kernel. Which is h of x minus y t. It has all these things, root 2 pi t, has e to the minus x minus y squared upon 2t. And the most important thing is it is positive for t greater than 0. It's a little hard to say what exactly it is for t equals 0. I mean, I think we should consider it as a limit. The delta function is t equals 0, which merits further discussion, but maybe not now. But for t positive, it's well-defined and positive. So then, u of x t is, of course, h convolution with f, h of t convolution with f as a function of x. And that is given by an integral. And the first simplest thing to state is this is non-negative, this is non-negative, so this has to be non-negative. Just by pointing your finger. Clearly, can't. But in fact, to tell you the truth, in maximum principles pervade mathematics, pervade PDE, and this is a case where you get greater than or equal to. It's the weak maximum principle. So just an observation says, without doing anything more, it already satisfies a weak maximum principle. It has to be greater than or equal to. But in fact, we can force it to be greater than. And so let's get the strong maximum principle. And I also want to put an estimate in. So a strong case with an estimate. So let's do the following thing. And what I want to prove is that unless f is 0, then so if f is positive somewhere, then u has to be strictly bigger than 0 everywhere. And I'm going to give, and not only that, I'm going to give a lower bound. Not a great lower bound, but a lower bound nonetheless. Okay? So let's do it as follows. Let's let B be a set. It'll be the x in R such that f of x, the data, is greater than delta. So now b depends on delta. And it could be empty if delta is very large. But unless f is identically zero, there's some delta, or there are a bunch of deltas, where this has to be non-zero measure. So let me say that again. For some, possibly small delta, but greater than zero, b has positive measure, and not only that, there is a inside b, where a is bounded, so a is bounded, and measure a greater than zero. And then, let me make some C's. Then let's write out what U is. U of XT, let's see, we're making think of T as being a bit positive. What's U of X? Let's write out U of X is T. It's integral H of X minus Y T F of Y dy. But it's integral all over all of R. So since both of these are positive, if I don't integrate over all of R, but I actually just only integrate over A, I get possibly a smaller number. Could be equal, but at least it's smaller. A is a set, bounded set inside B delta with positive measure. And of course, on A, F is bounded below. F is at least delta on A. I guess I could have F greater than or equal to delta. I probably should have had that. So this is integral over A of H of X minus Y of T times delta dy. Well, times I just bound F below by delta. I can even put the delta outside. Maybe it's neater that way. And now, integral of H over of a set of positive measure is patently positive. I mean, it's a... So here's some set A, and I'm integrating H so this is patently positive, has no, it's positive measure, there's no way that can vanish, but it even has a lower bound. You can even say that it gets low, so we're already done, because the integral of a Gaussian over a positive measure set is positive for T, but you can get a better lower bound by saying, why don't we just do the following. We'll say that this is greater than the delta survives. What's the minimum H is on A? So we could say it's the measure of A times the minimum H over A. So that's the nth over Y in A of the heat kernel, 1 upon root 2 pi T e to the minus X minus Y squared over 2 T, which is some number. Of course, if A is on Mars, as I said, and we're here, it's a very small number, but non-zero. And that proves our theorem. So I'd like to say that our interpretation of the solution of the heat equation as a distribution motivates the question about moments of solutions of the heat equation. So let me ask that. So first I guess I should say what a moment is of a function. So I'd like to say just this discussion is very standard with regard to the heat equation, but the question of moments actually maybe is a little bit less standard. So we're supposed to enjoy ourselves with this. Oops, I lost my first sheet. Oh, yeah. So if I have a distribution function, so given So let me say what I want to say. I want to talk about moments. So we're given a distribution, say, in the form of f of x dx, then its moments are going to be something like, so that the kth moment of f is going to be the integral of x to the k f of x dx. Could be infinite. If f decays very well, then they'll all be finite. Okay, and what I want to think about is the heat kernel. So for instance, I have a heat kernel H of x and t. Let's center y at 0 for simplicity. So that's the heat kernel. Then let's take some moments. So the zeroth moment of H, it's of course integral 1 upon root 2 pi t e to the minus x squared upon 2t dx. And by our knowledge gleaned from calculus of Gaussian integrals, that's 1. That's why I'm dragging the root 2 pi around. Otherwise, I wouldn't bother. The first moment of h is equal to the integral of x, just following this, 1 upon root 2 pi t e to the minus x squared upon 2t dx. Now, I did the first integral. Can you do the second integral for me? It's equal to 0. That's the trick, even odd. M2 of h, integral of x squared, 1 upon root 2 pi t, not so easy this time, e to the minus x squared over 2t dx equals, when you study probability, you can do these in your head. Close. It doesn't have that Brownian scaling. I need to put in a t and take out a t, and now it's 1, and that extra t gave me t. Good. Problem set problem. What are the moments in general? So problem set. Problem number 2. Derive expressions for the kth moment of the heat kernel. Just at x, t. There'll be functions of t. So I want an expression for this. I already did the first three for you, so you only have infinitely many left. Of course, you have to invent a method then to get it. So let's consider initial data for the heat equation. And of course, the solution procedure yields. So the solution gives, I've written this about 6 times and I'm going to do it again, the heat kernel convolution, the initial data. That's a function of x. And what I'm interested in are the moments. So how do the moments behave? How are the moments evolving? Question. So the moments, of course, mk of u of xt is going to be equal to the integral of x to the k u of xt dx. I want to know how these are functions of t. How do they behave? So, and I can might as well rewrite this. The integral x to the k, 1 upon root 2 pi t, e to the minus x minus y squared over 2t f of y dy, that gives us u, and then x to the k, I have to take the moment, that's dx. I want to know the behavior of these integrals as time goes on. So I have a first statement I want to make about moments. let me tell you my feelings, but I feel that I'm going a little slowly and I'm not really absolutely filling in all the material that I wanted to in this time slot. Is everyone completely bored to tears, or am I moving at the right speed, or am I moving too fast? Let's see. About right. How about if I just see people's hands? Is it about right? Is it vastly too slow? Oh, by the way, postdocs are not allowed to vote. Vastly too fast. Okay, so approximately calibrated. I could go a little faster, and that would be a strain, but not too bad. So proposition 2.9, which is the first two moments, the moments are conserved. The moments, the first two moments are, I mean, M0 and M1 are conserved. Meaning M0 of U is equal to M0 of F, and M1 of U is equal to M1 of F. And here's the proof. Where did my proof go? I guess I didn't put it in. It's going to be up to you, I believe. But, of course, we have to derive... I want to omit the proof, and you know what? Let's put it here. This is part two of problem set two, so let's make it... It's a humble problem, part three. So, proof proposition 2.9. It gets slightly more elaborate in a second. But I want to actually discuss how the higher modes... So the question is then, how do the higher moments behave? And of course, you can tell from my demeanor, are they conserved? You can probably read off by, you know, good student instinct. You can read off, but probably not, because I wouldn't mention it. I'd just put it on the list in the proposition. They're not conserved. So I wonder how they behave. So I want to work on that, and also it's an excuse to talk about properties of the Fourier transform. So I want to now put down another proposition which has purely to do with the Fourier transform. So proposition 2.10, which is, again, with my disclaimer, in two sections we're going to talk more about the analysis of the Fourier transform, and I'll stop feeling guilty. You can tell I'm feeling a little guilty now. For sufficiently well-behaved functions. Comma, the Fourier transform has the property, has the following property. One is that if I take x to the k g of x and I take the Fourier transform, out comes I d by d xi to the k g hat of xi. So if I take that and I Fourier transform, I get derivatives on the Fourier transform. And item two was, if I take the integral of g of x dx, there's an expression for that in the Fourier transform. I don't have to write an arrow. It's equal to root 2 pi g hat at 0. I mean, maybe it's not, doesn't look so related to this. Well, maybe so, because of moments, but they're completely related. I'm going to use one to prove the other. So let's do the proof, and we'll do first things first. The integral of e to the minus I c x of x to the k g of x dx, with g behaving as well as possible at infinity, so I can integrate by parts. Well, I haven't got there yet, but as I integrate by parts, I'm going to interpret this x to the k as multiplying the e to the minus I kx. That's just changing your focus in the integrand. But that's, I just want to observe that x e to the minus I k I cx is otherwise known as d by dc e to the minus I cx, because a c derivative brings down a minus I c, then I have to write an I to turn the minus I into a 1. So I can rewrite this as I d by dc, and I can do it k times e to the minus I cx g of x. Oh, I dx, dx, dx. What am I doing? Oh, I'm doing the right thing. Sorry, I just got confused. I dx to the k gx dx. And if I'm fortunate in a good class of functions, that c derivative needn't be under the integral sign, which is my statement 1. Just by reading off what the Fourier transform is. I guess I was lacking a root 2 pi here, so I also allowed to have it here, and then therefore it comes here. Yep, the Fourier transform. Secondly, I'd like to integrate g of x dx. And I like to view this as the following thing. E to the minus I cx g of x dx just happened to evaluate c at 0. The fact that e to the minus I cx when c is 0 is 1. But of course, this is not quite the Fourier transform, but modulo the factor 2 pi it is, which is g at 0, which is proofs 2, which probably you're already way ahead of me and you already proved it. And now I want to use this information to compute moments. Oops, sorry. I want to use this information to compute moments, so let's see. I need to study the moment of u of x t, x to the k. But instead of taking its integral, I'd rather take its Fourier transform and evaluate it at 0. Okay, so now take its Fourier transform. Slight notation difficulties, because that's a function of c after putting a hat on it. It's equal to I d by d c to the k power against u hat of c and t, which is equivalent to I d by d c to the kth power. Now, u hat, we know about the Fourier transform of the heat kernel. So u hat turns out to be h hat of c and t, the Fourier transform of the heat kernel, times f hat of c. But a convolution turns into something with an extra root 2 pi. So we know that. And therefore, the integral of this quantity without the hat, so the m, the kth moment of u, it's equal to x to the k, u of x, t dx is equal to root 2 pi I d c to the k u hat c t. But now I need to evaluate, so the integral of this is root 2 pi this at the origin, so I need to evaluate this at c equals 0. and now use this product rule, which says that this is equal to, in fact, 2 pi. This 2 pi and this 2 pi, root 2 pi is 2 pi, times I dc to the k, a product, h hat of ct with f hat of xi. And then after you do all those all that differentiation, you set xi is equal to 0. And so all it takes now is a sturdy mind to differentiate a few things. Oh, let's just check. It seems to me I'm about to check. I'm about to prove proposition 2.9. But that's okay. You can prove it too, maybe by a different method, if you want. Okay, so let's just check m0 of u is equal to 2 pi times no derivatives times h hat f hat. H hat of 0 t, f hat of 0. But that's equal to 2 pi h hat of 0 t is h hat at the origin, which is 1. So it leaves me as root 2 pi, that leaves the remaining 2 pi, f hat of 0. But that's equal to the moment, the zeroth moment of f. So that's the first part of the proposition. And now about m1. m1 of u is equal to, sorry, I have to nick this off so I can carry on, is equal to 2 pi by this formula, I d by dc of a product, h hat c t f hat c. Now evaluate at c equals 0 to get the moment. And we can do derivatives products, 2 pi I, take the I out, going to be two terms, dc h hat times f hat, plus h hat times dxc f hat, all evaluated at c equals 0. Now, quick, what's the derivative with respect to c of h hat at c equals 0? If I ever say quick, the answer has to be either 0 or 1 or something really, really simple. It's 0 because h hat is this Gaussian, e to the minus c squared upon c squared t upon 2, that's even. So its derivatives at the origin are odd, so vanish. Plus the remainder. And what's h hat ct at the origin? It's that 1 upon root 2 pi again. So this turns out to be 2 pi h hat at the origin, t, dc f hat at the origin, which is just equal to the first moment of f. Take a root 2 pi for the h hat and a root 2 pi for the dcf. So it proves that proposition. Why don't you prove it in a different way, just to I forgot I had a proof of this in the class. So prove it in a different way, just to keep your mind active. So for general, the moment k, what do we do? Well, it seems to me that this is formula 10, and you take m, the kth moment of u. Well, didn't we? I'm just writing down the formula. 2 pi I d by dc to the kth power, this product, h hat xct, f hat xc, evaluated xc equals 0. And now we can do products. 2 pi. I'm going to take all the i's out just to be clean, I to the k. And now when I differentiate k times a product, it's like the binomial theorem distributing the derivatives among the functions. So it's a sum, j equals 0 to k, dc j h hat ct, dc k minus j, f hat of c, evaluate the whole thing, c equals 0. But I forgot that it's the binomial theorem, right? You have to distribute the derivatives, so there's a factor, j equals 0 to k of j choose k. And so, just examining it right, it's a sum. You can put the i's back. J many i's here, k minus j many i's here. The root 2 pi is going to be used. The 2 pi is going to be one root of it here, the other root of it here. And we're just going to come up with k's choose j. K choose j. My notation was wrong. And the first one, of course, is going to give us the jth moment of the heat kernel. And the second one is going to give the k minus jth moment of the initial data. Sum j is equal to 0 to k. And we can do one more thing, which is when j is odd, we're taking an odd number derivative of an even function, the Gaussian, and evaluating at 0. So the only time this is going to survive is if j is even. Otherwise, it's 0. So it even cuts out half the terms. That's kind of interesting that the moments don't stay put, but you can calculate them, how they go. And they depend on, the kth moment depends on the 0 through kth moment of the initial data in a certain dependency way. I put that on because later when we talk about Schrodinger equation, we're going to discuss the moments. And they behave completely differently. Very interesting. I want to be able to compare it, the two. I also wanted to, you know, exercises with regard to the Fourier transform. Okay, I want to now talk about two more things, which may or may not fit into the lecture today. The first is a mathematical fact that heat flow contracts L2 norm, and heat flow also contracts, well, at least it does not expand L1 norm. Not by a fixed amount, but to some extent. Okay, so these are mathematical facts about the behavior of the L1 norm and the L2 norm of a solution as time goes on. And the second fact, and I probably have time to do that, and the second one, I wanted to describe heat flow. I want to derive heat flow from another principle, which is the principle of gradient flow for the energy functional. And that allowed me to define what a gradient is, a gradient of a functional on a function space is. But let's see how far we get before we lose patience, okay? So let's see. And I also wanted to do the following thing, that I've been sticking one dimension for simplicity, but in fact there's an expression for the heat kernel, there's a maximum principle. There's only I can only think of one thing that would change, and that is the dimension has to come into the heat kernel. So in X in Rn, the heat kernel, the only change I would make for all the blackboards I've written, the heat kernel Xt is going to be e to the minus x squared over 2t, 1 upon root 2 pi t. And the only change you have to make is that this isn't to the nth power. And everything else goes through. Separation of variables, I guess. So what I want to do is let's just consider x and Rn. And just to extend the discussion a little bit, not that I couldn't have done all the previous stuff in Rn, but just made integrations with parts just slightly more gentle until now. So that means that the heat equation is now going to be equation 11, which is d by dt u equals 1/2 Laplacian of u. And u at x 0, I want to start out with this initial data f of x. X is in Rn. T will be in R plus. I want to stick in that setting. So I have a proposition. And on proposition 2.11 at this point, it's the following thing. I want to let uxt solve the heat equation. So it's now equation 11 with data f in L2. then, and I want to talk about the solution which is given by the heat kernel, not those crazy non-unique solutions that we're going to effectively rule out after when we come back to the subject in several months. So then the L2 norm of U of X T is decreasing in time. Simply that I look at U and I take its L2 norm, well, it's an X dimension L2 norm over Rn, and it's less than or equal to the L2 norm of F with a constant 1. And let's put a proof in this. Again, with the slight disclaimers that I'm going to integrate by parts under integral signs and what have you without entirely justifying it, just for these first couple of weeks. So I want to see the time behavior of the L2 norm of U. A little bit easier if I square it, because then it's nicer to do the algebra. Well, it's equal to, the L2 norm is integral of U squared X T dx. So it's this derivative. And take the derivative under the integral sign, I've got the integral of 2 U of X T dt of U of X T dx. And that itself is equal to twice, let's see, a U of X T dt U of X T is 1/2 Laplacian U of X T dx, because it satisfies the heat equation. Let's get rid of the 2s. And now I can integrate by parts. It's equal to minus integral of grad U squared dx, which is patently, this is patently non-negative, so this is patently non-positive. So the L2 norm is decreasing. The crime against absolutely rigorous analysis is this integration of the parts and taking the limit over a large ball. Again, we're returning to that fact. So, secondly, I want to say something about what happens on L1. So that's proposition 212. Starting to look like a California ballot, if you ask me. Let F, I want data to be in L1. Again, of RD, of Rn. And consider, again, our U of XT a solution. Then, the L1 norm, U of XT, well, let's see, I guess we were thinking that that many situations, well, the L2 norm is often shows up, but in many situations, the L1 norm, because the integrals of densities are natural, not integrals of density squared, is more natural. So maybe this is the question we should be considering. And then this statement is, this is less than or equal to F and L1. Again, when it's constant 1. And so here's the proof. So there's an easy case and a hard case. Easy case is when F greater than or equal to 0. Because we then do the following thing. We take the time derivative of the integral of the absolute value of U dx. And the issue is, if I have U a smooth function, the absolute value of U may not be. Because X is a smooth function, but the absolute value of X has a corner. However, if F is greater than or equal to 0, U is greater than or equal to 0, and the absolute value doesn't even have to appear, because you never have to switch the sign over, because you never go negative. So it's equal to d by dt of integral of U of XT. And now we already know that this is equal to zero because we already had that proposition. It's the total heat. It's the total heat goes to zero. So we already proved this again by a integration by parts argument. Let's go to the hard case. NEF. So any f of x now. I don't want to take the absolute value of f because precisely I don't want to integrate by parts something which has corners in it because of the absolute value. So you consider some other function. So I wanted to study instead the integral of the root of u squared of xt plus epsilon squared. I'm just going to make epsilon positive. So take epsilon positive. Just so, now this is a smooth function of u. Just for that annoying, there's an extra derivative, there's a derivative that you don't want. So let's take dx, but of course I can't integrate a constant over everywhere, so I'll integrate over x less than or equal to r. I'm going to ask, how does this behave? And now we have to integrate a little bit. Sorry, we have to differentiate a little bit. So this is my formula 12. So let's go ahead. It's equal to the integral over x less than or equal to r of the derivative of this in respect to time gives me a u of xt dt of u of xt. Well, square root turns into 1 over square root u squared plus epsilon squared dx. And this itself is equal to the integral x less than or equal to r of u, and d by dt is 1/2 Laplacian u over square root of u squared plus epsilon squared dx. And now I want to integrate by parts. So let me see. I'm going to leave this here and move to the next board. So it's equal to, so integrate by parts, 1/2. Now this, one of these derivatives I want to put onto the rest of this function. So equal to minus 1/2 integral x less than or equal to r of, leave the gradient of u remaining. Maybe I better not put that in because it's going to, I know my expression is going to get quite large. But I have to differentiate this. The other gradient which goes over hits this and also hits that. So and the result is, you get 1 upon root u squared plus epsilon squared grad u, that's it's the numerator, minus u squared over u squared plus epsilon squared cubed grad u, all dot grad u dx. That's a little bit of vector calculus. But since I integrated out to r, there's a boundary term, plus integral 1/2 integral over x equals r. And the boundary term looks like u over root u squared plus epsilon squared grad u dot the outward normal d spherical area on a ball radius r. And I just want to do one more thing. This is equal to minus 1/2. Integral x less than or equal to r. I want to put these two together, so I have to multiply this up and move things around a little bit, and we find it's u squared plus epsilon squared over u squared plus epsilon squared cubed minus u squared. The grad u dot the grad u gives me mod grad u squared dx plus the boundary term. Now I want to do the following thing. Oh, note that this is clearly positive. Cancel the u squared against the minus u squared, epsilon squared, something or other positive, something or other positive. So I only get bigger if I put 0 there plus the boundary term. u squared plus epsilon squared grad u dot n ds. And then this holds, this says that this derivative is always bounded by this quantity. And now if I take the limit as r goes to infinity, I get an this term goes to zero, and then I get an inequality involving this expression, which has an epsilon in it. Then afterwards, if I take a limit as epsilon goes to zero, this quantity turns into the absolute value. And that proves the result. Okay, so just that calculation, and then you do two limits. R going to infinity gets rid of the boundary term, and then epsilon goes to zero. And that tells you that, in fact, not only do all these functions behave, decrease, but the absolute value decreases. Okay? And now I have my last paragraph of the day. I want to ask for your, well, I have to ask whether you want it or not, because it's 1234, maybe 1235. I was simply going to describe the heat equation as gradient flow. So, shall we do it? Yeah. Good. Put it right in the middle. So let's do this. Heat equation as gradient flow. And actually, I don't want to go up gradient lines. I want to go down gradient lines. So I'm just going to say, how do I call that? Maybe negative gradient flow. It just means I want to go down a function. Like I want to ski. Well, skiing is with inertia. Depends on how heavy you are. But it's like skiing fast. A light person skiing fast. So what's gradient flow? Anyone have any comments? First I should say, what's gradient flow? I should say, what's energy? So I mentioned it's going to be gradient flow of the energy. So let's make a functional E of u is equal to the integral of grad u mod squared dx, integrate over Rn. Actually, I don't want that functional. I want to divide by a quarter for reasons to emerge. So in order to talk about gradient flow, first I guess I should say, what is the gradient flow in finite dimensions? So let's take E. So first let me take plain old E, so a finite dimensional case. Let's take E of a function of a point V. Let's say V is in finite dimensions. Let's make it in D dimensions. And E is a smooth, real-valued function. I think I want E to be C2. I want to be able to take a derivative, but then I also like to be able to solve an ODE. So I'll take C2. And then its gradient, we've talked about E, V. It's actually an object which is defined using the Euclidean inner product. I just want to write that down for you. Defined in terms of the Euclidean inner product. Inner product or scalar product. Means that you have to do the following thing, really, to get the gradient. You do the following thing. You take E at the point V. That's, I want to compute the gradient at V. But then you move it a little bit by sigma capital V, say. And then you take a derivative with respect to sigma and evaluate at sigma equals 0. And that gives us something which depends on little v and big V, turns out to be linear in big V. And I want to represent it in terms of a vector inner product big V. So this is, you know, the Euclidean inner product. I mean, just the usual inner product between vectors in Rn. And that defines the gradient. This is the thing which I want to generalize. I'm just being careful. What can I say? I'm being slightly careful about coordinates. If you had another metric, you would also use this and put the other metric here, and it would change a little bit the coefficients of that vector. So what I want to do is the same thing. Oh, and then gradient flow. Not only do I have a vector field now, but I'm going to want to solve the following thing. D by dt of V is equal to grad E of V. And since I want to go down slope lines, I want to go minus grad E of V. And that's going down, that's decreasing, taking a point and making a curve V, which decreases as fast as possible the values of the function E. That's what it is. So now let's do that for a functional. So now I'm going to do it for energy. So I have E of a point U plus sigma W. And I want to take D by D sigma of this at sigma equals 0. And I want to write it in terms of the L2 inner product. Okay. So let's do this just by hand. So it's D by D sigma, sigma equals 0. Of the integral of grad U plus sigma W squared dx. Sorry, I'm being tedious. The D by D sigma, sigma equals 0. Integral, I just want to expand this out. I get a grad U squared term plus, oh, I forgot, a quarter, plus twice sigma grad U dot grad W, that's the cross term, plus sigma squared grad W squared. Nothing could be simpler. Now, of course, this derivative doesn't depend on sigma, so it goes out. And one derivative just gives me a remaining sigma that's left. So it vanishes when I set sigma equal to 0. So it's clear this is equal to 1 half integral grad U dot grad W dx. That's what the derivative is with respect to sigma. But it is not an object represented in terms of an L2 inner product. So what I want to do is, of course, integrate by parts. So it equals minus 1 half integral. If I take the gradient off the W and put it on the U, vector analysis tells us this is Laplacian of U times W dx. Plus boundary terms, I'm assuming at infinity, there's the boundary terms go away. So I'm assuming we're in a situation where the boundary terms go away. And now this I interpret as the inner product of W with the gradient of E. And this is the L2 inner product. But let me just rewrite that again. L2 inner product is W integrated into the gradient of E dx. So that tells me precisely what gradient of E is. It's this stuff. So gradient of E is equal to minus 1 half Laplacian U. And so finally, and sorry, I'll just put this into the little corner. If I now look at gradient flow, it says to take partial U is equal to minus gradient of E is equal to minus a minus is plus 1 half Laplacian U. 1 half Laplacian U. And that's our equation 11, describing the gradient flow of this energy with respect to the L2 inner product. Good place to stop. So let's stop now. Did they give you enough problem sets? Problem set problem. Not enough?